This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
That's good, low high.
This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. When Andy Tierstein, arts professor at NYU Tisch School of the Arts, was visiting our Swara just a couple of weeks ago, I managed to sneak an interview with him, elbowing my way into his busy schedule of engagements with young performers in training. He was in Kuala Lumpur on a very short stint, conducting a sharing workshop with both the students from the School of Performing Arts and also the more practiced professionals of traditional music, musicians who play the agung, rebab, kompang, gamelan, gambus, surunai, and others. I had seen this woolly-headed professor the weekend before at a performance of Hamlet in Malay performed by our Swara students in the institution's black box. The look in his searching eyes then revealed that he was no novice spectator, but a knowledgeable one. He took in this local adaptation of a Shakespeare play, which was performed with a live orchestra and singers. The setting, an imagined country in Nusantara. Andy Tierstein was watching to appreciate, to understand, and I suppose to hear and feel how this music, played and performed in a traditional style, took its shape in the world of music. Something in my head said, I must find out who this man is and what had brought him to the performance. When I next saw Andy, he was in a tight Aswara studio among 24 students and other more mature musicians. 3 young women peppered the predominantly male group. Everyone had their own musical instrument. Some of the participants were on chairs close to the walls. Most sat on floor mats. All were positioned in an ill-shaped circle with Andy, while another musician to his left was standing up. All snugly shaped and fitted like pieces of a jigsaw. Any time a musician stood up, the others had to lean to one side or the other to make room for the apologetic wanderer to take a step. A young man sitting among the kanung, and to Andy's right, doubled as his interpreter. The room was noisy. It seemed as if everyone was talking, even though Andy Tierstein appeared to have the floor and was detailing what he wanted the musicians to do. Soon, he started the group clapping. He set the rhythm and invited the musicians, a section at a time, to follow. Occasionally, he had them slap their thighs. Then the percussion instruments were introduced. One by one, they came insinuating themselves into the percussive music like lovers slipping in between sheets, unobtrusively, quietly, and then as if breathing into place. This was the sound of improvisation, the initial attempts of bringing together the East and the West, Andy Tierstein from New York, and traditional musicians from our country. A kind of foreplay was taking place. A little reaching out, touching tentatively, then touching more, then an embrace. As if that number were over, Andy then started the group singing a traditional American song from the days of slavery. He led the musicians through the paces. For a moment, when the voices floated up, familiar images of American history dropped down of black slaves working in the cotton fields and singing of the promised land to come in the life after. The musicians responded with both their voices and their traditional instruments. And Andy brought out his harmonica and exhaled into it. Red River Valley on the mouth organ and accompanied by traditional Malay instruments. Mm. Red River Valley, the tune melted into Lenggang Kangkung. More chatter and instructions, and Andy got out a violin and he started to fiddle. Bluegrass music with notes from Kentucky, North and South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia with hints of its roots in Ireland. A couple of the younger students got up to dance, and Andy showed them the moves. Feet together and bouncing from the knees, the dancers held their hands up above their heads and they moved to the beat. Folks in Appalachia never danced to no music like that. Folks in Appalachia never heard no music like that at their shindigs. In the short time in the studio observing the musicians play, perhaps the better word would be jam with Andy, I saw and heard him play the harmonica, the violin, the guitar. I heard him sing and saw him dance. Coming up, a chat with Andy Tierstein, arts professor, composer, researcher of traditional music, and not least of all, a performer. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. You're tuned to Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. Just a couple of weeks ago, I got to talk to Andy Tierstein, a professor from the New York University Tisch School of the Arts. He was here running a music workshop. Earlier in the first half of the show, we got to hear what kind of music he was trying to create, melding Western music with Eastern traditional instrumentation. I asked him what led him to Malaysia. This was his first visit.
I am here for a cultural dialogue. I am somebody who cares about the folk roots of people around the world. I am doing music that is influenced by folk musics from many places. And I am here to have a dialogue with people about their culture and my culture, an exchange of cultures, to teach something about American roots music and a little bit dance, even of traditional American dance. And to learn more about your dances and songs.
One of the questions that ran through my mind while researching on you is, are you a performer? Performer as in an actor? Are you a performer as an instrumentalist musician? Are you a composer? Are you a dancer? Just now I watched you and you played the mouth organ, you played the violin and you fiddled with it. You played the guitar, you danced.
Yes, well, thank you. You know, I started out as a circus performer. My first performing was as a clown, a musical clown. So in the clown tradition, the real classical clown tradition, the clown has to learn all the different skills, the acrobatic skills, the trapeze. So it's the same way that I apply to all music. I mean, it's all music to me. It's all the same, whether it's, you know, from different cultures, different instruments. It's different extensions of one language, which is the language of music. And even dance, since I started out as a musical clown, I was playing the violin on the high wire or playing the violin as a clown and balancing a guitar on my head and things like that. So it's always been physical. It's a physical experience. Music should always be a physical experience. This is why I am sad about the rectangle culture, the culture of people looking into staring into their rectangles so much, whether it's the telephone, the phone, or the computer, the TV, just staring at these rectangles and not moving their bodies. And it's very sad.
You teach at the Tisch School of the Arts. What do you teach?
I teach in the dance department. I teach music. So I'm teaching music history, 20th century music, music composition for choreographers, because many choreographers actually are interested in music in a deeper way. And sometimes I also teach the people in the music department how to collaborate with the choreographers.
As part of your teaching about modern and contemporary music, what constitutes modernity in music?
That is a very good question. Modernism was a movement that was at the early 20th century. In music, it was hinted at with Debussy, even at the end of the 19th century. But then it became much bigger with Stravinsky. Once the Rite of Spring happened in 1913, then we started to see a real blossoming of modernism, which was also happening in all the arts at that time. And what is it in music? Well, it's a tendency towards abstraction to some degree. There's abstraction, there's
like
deconstruction,
abstract.
Like abstract art. But there are people who have always felt that traditional roots music, the folk music, should also be part of the experience of modernity. So the biggest shining light for musicians is Bartók, Béla Bartók. Was a great Hungarian composer, and his music was drawn from folk roots, but he's one of the great avant-garde modernist composers at the same time.
What's happening now in contemporary music? How has that moved from modern music?
In the 1980s, there grew a new movement called minimalism, and minimalism was people like Philip Glass, Steve Reich, and these guys. If you look carefully at their bios, they all went to other countries and learned folk music of those countries, interestingly enough. For Steve Reich, it was Africa and also other places. And for Philip Glass, it was India. His experience in India with Ravi Shankar completely changed the way he looked at time. So then we have composers beginning to look at time differently. But in a larger sense, there was a movement from the abstraction of Arnold Schoenberg and the 12-tone system of music, which was very brainy, it was all in the head, a movement towards looking at other cultures, at global cultures in context, and using those cultures as a resource. So now, any composer who is writing music needs to know about the musics of the world. And we see that this has been happening now for 30 years, that people have been influenced by world music, and it's just more and more and more.
When you say that the 12 tones is quite intellectual and all in the head, is there something mathematical about it and that's why it's quite heady?
Absolutely. These are really good questions. These are questions that we have in music in my classes. You know, Arnold Schoenberg was an Austrian composer who threw out the tonal system. He decided that all of music has a journey from a tonal root to other places and coming back home to the root, to that home tone. But he decided, no, we don't want to have tonal music anymore. We want to have dissonance be free, not to resolve, but the conflict can remain as a conflict and even not be a conflict anymore, just a richer sense of sound. So at first he didn't know what to do with that. He just threw out the tonal system and he just started to make music that was just anything that tones that occurred to his expressive nature, usually related to poetry, would affect his music. And then in the early 1920s, he developed a system of 12 tones. And it's almost like a little game where you have to use each of the 12 chromatic tones of a piano, in a piano, half steps, each of those 12 tones in one octave before you can go back to start over. But you can decide what order they are in. So it's called a tone row, and it's called serialist music because it's a series of tones. And it becomes very mathematical because then you make a big magic square and you write in your tones 0 through 11, which is 12 tones including 0, and then you can invert them at your row and make it inverted. You can make it backwards. You can play with it in different ways. So that was a very mathematical system. It's always a paradox because this movement was called expressionism. And it was thought to be incredibly emotional, actually, by the people who made it. They were going for the supreme expression, the most intense kind of expression in the unconscious. This is just after Sigmund Freud had his theories of the unconscious, and people were reaching into these darker realms and let them come out in the music. And yet, for my students and for many people, when they start to study 12-tone music, it feels like it has no emotion to them. It feels abstract. Although, everyone listens to this kind of music in the movie theater. Everyone. Because in all the horror movies, in all the intense scenes, you hear that music, that kind of effect that really was started by this composer, Arnold Schoenberg.
Just now, when you were working with the musicians, and these are the musicians from Aswara and their invited guests, you included some traditional instruments, and they didn't seem to play in the kind of 12 tones. Mm-hmm. The rebab, which looks like a violin of sorts.
Right.
And the
serenay,
which is a wind instrument. Yeah. And it also doesn't seem to follow that kind of clear do, re, mi, fa, so.
Ah, yeah. That's very perceptive, yes. You know, in the West, what happened was that the piano dominated the culture. And when the piano, first through the harps, the organ, many years ago in the medieval times, and then in the harpsichord, and finally the piano, you know, in the 18th century and so forth, and the piano became a very powerful instrument, and it dominated the culture. So suddenly people were used to that piano, and you'll notice on a piano you cannot have anything except a half step. And in this way, the Western culture moved away from the human voice, because the human voice can go, it's not just half steps, it's quarter steps, it's tiny things. And this is the same way with the reed instruments and with the violin, the rebab. It can go, can slide.
And yet for the most part, the violin is restricted to playing mostly those.
That's exactly true. Mostly it is. Mostly it is, except in the blues and the jazz and things like that.
Now, coming to the music that you have composed, I mean, I had listened to some of the excerpts from Manahata. What were you trying to achieve in that kind of music, where there is the spoken word that sits on a bed of music? Sometimes it's the mandolin, sometimes it's the harpsichord, like your story about Bach.
That CD is an early CD of mine. It's from 1993, I think, or something like that. Most of the music on that CD, called Manahata, which is available on Amazon, that CD is, most of that music is written originally for dance, for dance companies. And then I recycled it. I took it and I said, I'm going to make a CD. On the CD, you don't see the dance, you just have the music. So what can I do with it? And I thought, well, let's play with some texts. Let's try some different things with it. So that's why you have music that began with dance commissions. People would ask me to write music for their dance pieces, which I love to do. And then I divorced it from that context and recycled it and put new words to it. So even the title, Manahata, is the original indigenous name for Manhattan, for the Manhattan Island in New York City, where I live. And that is a poem written by Walt Whitman, a great American poet. So I took that poem and just put it over a piece I had written for a dance company.
You are also a researcher and writer on contemporary performance practice. And then this, with your music as composer, how do they all dovetail into what you do?
You know, I am now 58 years old, and I am still a beginner. I'm always learning and learning and learning. There's so much to learn. So I haven't figured out yet how it all comes together. And it's an interesting balance, because you want to reflect and observe what's happening around you. And this is where the writing comes in, to write words down, to write about people's music and write about things that have happened and trends and stuff like that. And then you also want to, as Rumi, the poet Rumi, said, take your head off. Take off your head, he said. So sometimes you want to take your head off and just put it aside and just let the music come out. I'm still finding out how it all comes together. But to me, it's the same idea of the musical clown who has to learn all the different techniques. And that way you become a more full artist.
You are Jewish?
I am. I confess.
How does the history of the Jews weigh in on what you do? Meaning, how does what's happened in the world right now, what happened in World War II, how does that seep in or inform the music you produce?
Well,
or is that not even a relevant question?
I think it's relevant. I do write some things that are directly related to Jewish music and Jewish subjects. I wrote an opera called A Blessing on the Moon, which is an adaptation of a novel. And that is a post-Holocaust novel, very imaginative, by Joseph Skybel, a wonderful novelist, A Blessing on the Moon. That opera is, you know, the story of a Jewish man who is killed, and then his ghost revisits his home after he is murdered by the Poles. And sometimes I do that. I write music that is directly related to Jewish themes. I don't know if there is a Jewish music influence on my music vocabulary. I feel like I'm an international composer. I'm not a Jewish composer, let's say. But I do identify with my Jewish roots. I think it's a beautiful treasure that many people who are Jewish ignore. I am enjoying the learning always about my Jewish culture. And the Jew is also somebody who is a traveler, a displaced person through history, a wanderer who picks up different aspects of cultures around the world, but also tries to retain the root of its own culture, Judaism. And that's what I'm doing. And that's what we're doing here, really. I think the Malaysian artists here at Aswara do this naturally. They all have to learn, apparently, traditional arts as well. And they learn to keep that in a real way, not to do a fake kind of learning of these arts, like to tip your hat at it, but to really learn to become experts in the traditional arts, like the Mayung or things like that. And then from there, they can branch out and become artists who are also contemporary artists. You know, the tradition is not the enemy of the innovation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andy Tierstein, composer, performer, researcher, and arts professor at NYU Tisch School of the Arts. I'm sure he'll be back in the country again in the not-too-distant future, and perhaps to work on some original compositions with the musicians he encountered here. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.